Picture the Seine, just outside Paris. It's June of 1914. There's a crowd on the riverbank, judges with clipboards, and a little Curtiss flying boat coming around for a low pass over the water. And then the pilot stands up. He climbs right out of his seat, hands off everything, and steps out onto the lower wing while the airplane keeps flying straight and level down the course. And if that isn't enough, his mechanic climbs out onto the other wing to balance him. Two men standing on the wings, and nobody is flying the airplane, except something is. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Vector, and this is Clear Direct. Today, we're going all the way back to the very first piece of cockpit automation that ever actually worked, and then we're going to follow that thread forward, gyroscope by gyroscope, to the autopilot sitting in your panel right now, because here's what most people miss. The debate we're having today about automation and pilot skill, it started on a riverbank in France more than 100 years ago. Let's break this down. This segment is supported by AviationSoul.com. They make aviation challenge coins that mark the real milestones. First solo, private pilot, instrument rated, CFI. The whole journey, beautifully made and built to last. If you've got a milestone worth marking, or somebody in your life who does, that's AviationSoul.com. So who was standing on that wing? His name was Lawrence Sperry, 21 years old, and he came by this honestly because his father was Elmer Sperry, the man who gave the world the gyro compass and the ship stabilizer. Elmer had figured out how to use a spinning gyroscope to keep a battleship from rolling in heavy seas. Lawrence looked at that and asked a different question. What if you could do it for an airplane? Now, to understand why that was such a big deal, you have to remember what flying was like in 1914. The airplane was barely 10 years old. These machines were unstable by nature. They wanted to wander, to drop a wing, to nose up or down. Flying one meant constant, exhausting correction on the controls, every second, with your hands and your feet. There was no such thing as relaxing. A cross-country flight was a workout, and the moment you lost sight of the horizon in cloud or in haze, you were in real trouble because your inner ear will lie to you. Pilots didn't have instruments to tell them which way was up. A lot of them died finding that out. So the problem Sperry set out to solve was fundamental. Can we build a machine that knows which way is level and can hold the airplane there without a human touching anything? Here's the physics, and it's beautiful in its simplicity. A spinning gyroscope has a property called rigidity in space. Spin a wheel fast enough, and it wants to keep pointing exactly where it's pointing no matter what you do to the frame around it. You can tilt the airplane, yaw it, bank it, and that spinning wheel just stays put, holding its original orientation like a stubborn little compass that points at nothing but itself. So, now you've got a reference. The gyro stays level while the airplane moves around it. And the gap between the two, the difference between where the gyro says level is and where the airplane actually is, that gap is information. That's your error signal. Sperry's genius was closing the loop. He connected the gyroscopes to the flight controls through a system of servos, driven by pneumatic and hydraulic pressure. When the airplane rolled away from level, the gyro sensed the difference, and the servos pushed the ailerons to roll it back. When the nose dropped, the system pulled it back up. Four gyroscopes, mounted to sense pitch and roll, wired into the controls through a feedback loop that never got tired and never got scared. He called it the gyroscopic stabilizer. We'd call it an autopilot. And in 1914, at a safety competition on the Seine called the Concours de la Sécurité en Aéroplane, he proved it worked in the most theatrical way a 21-year-old possibly could, hands off, out of the seat, standing on the wing with his mechanic, Emile Kitchin, out on the other side, while the airplane flew itself straight down the course. The judges gave him 50,000 francs, and the world got its first real look at automation in the cockpit. Now, here's where the engineer in me wants to slow down, because I don't want to oversell it. That 1914 system was a wing leveler and an attitude holder. It kept the airplane upright and pointed roughly where you left it. It did not navigate. It did not manage power. It did not know where the airport was. It solved exactly one problem, the problem of stability, and it solved it well enough that a human didn't have to fight the airplane every second of every flight. And that one problem, stability, turned out to be the foundation for everything. Because think about what that gyro really gave us. It gave us an artificial horizon. That same spinning wheel that could drive the ailerons could also drive a little display on the panel, a card that showed you level even when your eyes and your inner ear couldn't. The attitude indicator, the instrument at the center of your panel right now, the one that lets people fly through cloud and live, is a direct descendant of Sperry's gyro. The autopilot and the flight instrument grew from the same root. The data tells an interesting story about what happened next. By the 1930s, that basic gyro autopilot had matured enough that in 1933, Wiley Post flew around the world solo, and he leaned on an early Sperry autopilot to do it, because no human can hand-fly for that many hours without sleep. In World War II, autopilots held the big bombers steady on the bomb run. By the jet age, we'd added heading hold, then altitude hold, then the ability to track a radio beam down to a runway. Each layer solved one more problem: hold the wings, hold the heading, hold the altitude, follow the course, fly the approach. And then the computer arrived, and we got the flight management system, and suddenly the airplane could fly an entire route, climb, cruise, descent, and approach from a plan you typed in before you ever left the gate. The autothrottle managed the engines. The Autoland could put a wide body on the runway in fog thick enough that the pilots couldn't see the numbers until the wheels were already rolling. That's a straight line, 100 years long, from a man standing on a wing to a machine that lands itself. And every step of it made flying safer. I want to be clear about that, because it's true, automation took the single deadliest category of accident, loss of control, the airplane getting away from the pilot, and it hammered that number down. A tired pilot makes mistakes. A distracted pilot misses things. The gyro never gets tired and never gets distracted. But here's the honest other side. And Sperry's story actually contains the warning inside it. Automation is very good at doing exactly what you told it to do. It is not good at knowing whether what you told it to do makes sense. The industry has a name for the failure mode: automation dependency. It's what happens when pilots get so used to managing the machine that they lose the raw stick and rudder feel underneath it. The autopilot flies beautifully right up until the moment it hits something it wasn't designed for, and then it hands the airplane back to a human who hasn't hand-flown in weeks and isn't ready. We've lost airplanes that way. Perfectly good machines, flown into the ground or stalled out of the sky, because the automation quit or got confused and the humans in the seats had, in that moment, forgotten how to just fly the airplane. Here's what most people miss. The problem is almost never that the automation broke. The problem is the handoff. It's the gap between what the machine understood and what the pilots understood. The airplane thinks it's doing exactly the right thing. The pilots think the airplane is doing something else. And that gap, that error signal between the human and the machine, is where the accidents live now. Sperry closed the loop between the gyro and the controls 100 years ago. The loop we still haven't fully closed is the one between the automation and the person supposed to be supervising it. So who's working on this today, and where's it actually going? In the airliner world, the emphasis has swung back toward what the training people call manual flying proficiency. Airlines that spent years telling crews to keep the automation on are now deliberately telling pilots to click it off and hand fly, to keep the muscle alive. The pendulum swung all the way to full automation, and now it's swinging back toward balance, because we learned the hard way that a pilot who can only supervise is not the same as a pilot who can fly. Down in general aviation, and this is the part that's genuinely exciting to me, the digital autopilot has gotten cheap, and it's gotten smart in a way that helps instead of hurts. Companies like Garmin and Genesis with the old S-Tech line, and Dynon, and Trio, and Bendix King are putting real digital two-axis and three-axis autopilots into small airplanes that used to have nothing but a wing leveler if they were lucky. And the best of these systems added something Sperry never had: envelope awareness. If you hand-fly toward a stall or an overbank, the servos push back. They nudge you off the edge. There's a mode on some of them where you push a button and the airplane levels itself out of an unusual attitude, straight and level, hands off, which is Lawrence Sperry's 1914 trick, turned into a safety net you can buy. And I'll give you the honest caveat, because that's the job. Those systems are only as good as the pilot's understanding of what mode they're in. The single most important skill in a modern cockpit isn't pushing the buttons. It's knowing at every second what the automation is doing and why, and being ready to take it away the instant it does something you don't like. The airplane will always do what it's told. Your job is to make sure it's being told the right thing, and to be the pilot who can fly it bare when the magic quits. Lawrence Berry, by the way, didn't get an easy ending. He was a wild one, a barnstormer, and an inventor both, and he died young in 1923 when his airplane went down in the English Channel. He was 30 years old, but the loop he closed on that river outside Paris is still running. It's running in the attitude indicator on your panel. It's running in the autopilot that holds your heading while you fold a chart. It's running, in a sense, every time an airliner breaks out of the fog with the runway already under the wheels. 110 years from a man on a wing to a machine that lands itself, and the question he raised is still the question. Not can the machine fly the airplane. It can. The question is whether the human in the seat still can too. My thanks to the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum and the National Aviation Hall of Fame for the history on the Sperrys, to the contemporary accounts from the aviation press of the day for the details of that Paris demonstration, and to the FAA's Advanced Avionics Handbook for the modern side of it. There's more on all of it over at RadioHanger.com. So the next time your autopilot clicks off and hands you back the airplane, remember there's a 21-year-old standing on a wing at the other end of that story. Keep your hands sharp. I'm Vector, fly the airplane.